Well, thank you. I realize I'm the last person here before you and lunch, so I'll try to keep it brief. I did notice there's some live music over in the mall today, so maybe people can check that out. I was able to update this presentation with 2012 data, so the title and the abstract and the program's a little bit off, but here we go. So I want to do a few things today. The data that I'm going to be talking about are from the medical monitoring project, and I realize you guys are going to be hearing all kinds of data over the course of these 3 days. So one of the things I'd really like to do today is talk about the value of MMP and encourage you all to see what a great surveillance project it is and take that information back to your states if you happen to be an MMP city or state, and work with your surveillance program or work with your MMP program and try to look for some more analyses and good things to do with these data, because it's quite a project. So I'm going to be looking at and describing key differences and similarities between the HIV and hepatitis C co-infected group and the HIV mono-infected group, and then talk a little bit about the unscreened population. So the Medical Monitoring Project, or MMP, is a national stratified complex sample survey with three stages. The first is CDC samples at the state, large city, and territory level. And then within those selected sites, they look at HIV care facilities, not emergency departments or transient care kind of things. And then from those HIV care facilities, they get patient lists of individual patients 18 years and older who received care from January through April of the data collection year. And the ultimate goal is to look at clinical and behavioral aspects of these people who are in HIV care and look at their care experience as well as some behaviors and prevention activities those people experience. So MMP is on an annual cycle, and there are two key periods to that cycle. The population definition period is January through April of the calendar year, and then the surveillance period is the 12 months before the interview of the patient. And much of the data that are collected are for that surveillance period, but then there are other data elements that are actually collected for the entire patient's history. For example, today I'll be talking about hepatitis C testing, and that's, did the patient ever have hepatitis C testing, not just in that previous 12 months. So there are two primary methods of collecting data. There's a lengthy and in-depth interview that can take from 45 minutes to an hour and a half, for which the individual receives not compensation, but a token of appreciation for that interview that can come in the form of, say, a check or a gift card. And then there's a medical record abstraction where a public health worker goes into the medical records or has them sent to us, or possibly, if we're fortunate, we have electronic access to some facilities records, and actually obtains quite a bit of medical record information from those patients' charts. And then we also, in a smaller way, supplement the data with data from EHARs, the HIV AIDS case registry. So you can see here a pretty comprehensive list of topics for which MMP is interested: demographics, access to care, HIV treatment and adherence, sexual behavior, drug and alcohol use, prevention activities, mental health, and health, general health conditions, and gynecological and reproductive history for women. So one of the benefits of the Medical Monitoring Project is the CDC can weight those data and then make population statements as a whole. And they spend quite a bit of time weighting those data. It's been an independently reviewed process. And they weight the data not only for the nation as a whole, but also for individual sites. One of the downsides of the complexity of the weighting process is it takes some time. So it's about 2+ years between the time we finish data collection and then we receive our weighted data back at the site, and fortunately, that time period is starting to come down a little bit, and CDC is working hard to reduce it even more. For these data today and in general, the CDC, when they're publishing MMP data, they're looking at those data for which there's a medical record abstraction and an interview. It doesn't have to be the case that that's a situation. It could be that we interview some more people and someone could choose not to have their medical record abstracted, or because it's a surveillance project, some sites are able to actually get more medical record abstractions in the absence of interviews. Today, I'm going to be looking at a combined year data set that provides average annual population estimates of individuals in care from January through April. So MMP data is a primary source for providing HIV viral load data for measuring the National HIV AIDS Strategy progress. It's a project that's, I think, really on the rise in terms of its level of esteem, both in CDC as well as in HRSA. It's a valuable source of data for local, state, and federal HIV prevention and care planning because it does have both the interview component as well as the medical record abstraction component. And it provides a wealth of information about health outcomes, how patients interact with the care system, barriers to care, behaviors that affect health outcomes, as well as behaviors that affect transmission of HIV. And the data are used in extensive publications and peer-reviewed journals, as well as presentations at national conferences. There are some challenges with MMP. It's a pretty complex project, and so there's quite a bit that goes into ensuring that all the different sites implement the protocols correctly and consistently. So the CDC provides direction to 16 states, 6 large cities, and 1 U.S. territory, some of which consider the project surveillance, others consider it research and have to go to the IRB for approval and amendments and that sort of thing, so that can slow down things a little bit. There's a heavy focus on the consistency of data collection and methods and protocols. And beginning June of this year, we just switched over to a new sampling method, case surveillance-based sampling. So rather than this facility-based sampling where we've been looking at people who have actually been in care, we're now sampling directly out of EHARs, so we're getting some people who are not in care or in marginal care, and we've actually been involved in a pilot project the last few years and running up against some of those challenges that Melissa described earlier in terms of actually finding those people. Can be time-consuming, but it's going to be, I think, really rewarding to start looking more closely at those people who, as Dan mentioned, you know, they're marginally in care or they've been out of care for some time and trying to find out why that is the case. So if you happen to see your state or city on here, go back to your state or city and look into this project more. It's a great project, and there's just a wealth of data to be had. So for today, when I talk about co-infection, I'm looking at hepatitis C positivity as being anyone who's had a positive hepatitis C test, whether that's a screening or an RNA test, and not a subsequent negative test. And by the nature of the project, everyone is HIV positive. That's why they're in HIV care. And some basic descriptive statistics using the CDC-provided weights and statistical significance calculated using SAS and chi-square measures of association. So why even be concerned about HIV and hepatitis C co-infection? Well, it quickens hepatitis C disease progression. It triples the risk for liver disease, liver failure, and liver-related death. It increases the chance that hepatitis C will be sexually transmitted, and it also increases the chance that a mother will infect her unborn child with hepatitis C. And treatment is available for both, but care management is more complex. There can be drug-to-drug interactions and increased pill burden, as well as drug toxicities. So before I jump into the MMP data, I just want to give you a little bit of context of HIV and hepatitis C in Washington overall. Like many states, our surveillance systems are definitely not equal for these two conditions. So HIV has been relatively well-funded and stable over many years, while hepatitis C surveillance has been somewhat on a shoestring. It has not been well-resourced at either the state or the local level, and we know that some counties, for example, just choose not to report hepatitis C. But in terms of HIV, we have about 500 new cases per year, and at the end of 2013, approximately 13,700 people living with HIV in Washington. 86% of our prevalent cases are among men, and of males, 60% were attributed to gay and bisexual sex, 9% to injection drug use plus sex with men, and only 4% injection drug use only. And 60% of the cases are 45 years or older. In terms of hepatitis C, we get about 4,500 cases per year, and that's with, we know, some counties not reporting. Approximately 60% male, approximately 63% are 45 years or older, and our case reports come in sometimes pretty scant on data, and only 14% are actually reported with any sort of risk factor, and not surprisingly, the most common risk is injection drug use. And in Washington, we're fortunate that we've had syringe exchange services operating in the state for many years. So in terms of co-infection among individuals in care for that period 2009 through 2012, on average, there was about 6,350 people in care, and of those, 15% were co-infected with hepatitis C. Looking here at some population differences by age, we see that the co-infected group is a bit older. So approximately 75% of the co-infected group is 45 years or older versus closer to 60% of the HIV-only group. And the co-infected group, the younger end of that, 18 to 34 years, only 6% versus 12.5% in the mono-infected group. Looking at population differences by year since HIV diagnosis, we can see that the co-infected group has been diagnosed for a longer period of time. About 65% have been diagnosed more than 10 years ago versus 56% for the mono-infected group. And here's some information about how things differ by level of education. We see that the mono-infected group is generally less educated, with less than 50% having some college or higher versus 73% of the mono-infected group. And in terms of the difference by income, 74% of the mono-infected group above the federal poverty level and only 41% of the co-infected group at a comparable level of income. The project tries to determine how well the patient can understand health materials, and here we see that the co-infected group has more challenges understanding health materials and needs help more often understanding the hospital materials, where 46% need that help half the time or more. One of the things the MMP does is try to look at patients' need for supportive services. And here we see that the service gap among the co-infected is double the service gap of the mono-infected group, where 20% of the co-infected group needed, had three or more service gaps, and only 10% of the mono-infected group. Both groups are predominantly white, non-Hispanic, and male. So everyone infected with HIV should be screened for hepatitis C, and those at high risk should be screened at least annually. And here we see that on average, about 20% of individuals in HIV care annually were not screened for hepatitis C. And it looks like these next few slides, it looks like that providers may be selectively not screening people based on education and income. And so here we see the not screened group has a higher level of education in terms of 77% have some college or higher. In terms of income, about 78% of the not screened group is above the federal poverty level versus 67% of the screened group. And in terms of race ethnicity, a higher proportion of the not screened group, white, non-Hispanic. Despite not being screened, there's kind of a mix in terms of how much those people need help understanding health materials. Only 7% had problems half the time or more learning about their medical condition because of difficulty understanding written information, while 33% had someone help them half the time or more with hospital materials, and almost 20% are not confident at all filling out medical forms by themselves. There is some health risks among the unscreened group, where a little bit more than a third reported using alcohol in the past year, and 6% reported injection drug use in the past year. So in conclusion, during the 2009 through 2012, compared to the mono-infected population, the co-infected group was older, less educated, had less income, needed more help understanding health materials, and had more service gaps. In terms of the unscreened group, about 20% of the HIV-positive persons in care had no evidence of being screened for hepatitis C. The unscreened population had a larger percentage of whites, had more education and more income than did the screened population. Significant percentages of the unscreened population needed help navigating the health system. A few limitations. The mono-infected group may actually have included some unscreened individuals who are actually co-infected, but the chart didn't indicate that. Individuals in the unscreened group may have been screened for hepatitis C, but the medical record lacked the documentation. And the medical record abstraction does not capture severity of illness due to hepatitis C, such as liver function tests. So that limits how much we can tell the care programs. Here's some acknowledgments to our community and provider advisors, Public Health, Seattle and King County, which has a large role in the project, our Washington State Department of Health, and the MMP team at CDC, and especially our two project officers, Dr. Linda Beer and Sheikha Garg. Thank you.
We have just a couple of minutes for questions.
It struck me when you were talking about the screen versus the unscreen that the differential between those was quite the opposite of what one saw, the difference between the co-infected and mono-infected. And I wonder if that reflects the nature of the people themselves, or does that reflect the providers who these particular people are seeing?
That's a good question, and something I think that's worth looking at a little bit more closely. You know, are the providers selectively not screening people based on their interpretation of risk, which I think is a reasonable thing to assume.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks.
And I'd like to do a round of applause for all of our people.